I think choices really are critically important, and I'd like to mention some of the reasons why I think that they are important. I think that in choosing and making our choices, really, we're forming our own selfhood. And to choose means to take up selfhood and responsibility. If I go into a restaurant and I say I order a meal, after the meal is over, the waitress says, "What would you like for a dessert? There's apple pie, sherbet, vanilla ice cream." And I say, "I don't know, I'll have whatever the people at the next table have." Okay? I won't choose, let somebody else choose for me. There are lots of times and ways in which we do that, and or at least are tempted to do that, and I think it's obvious. It's a way out from under taking responsibility for myself to make somebody else make the choices for me. Other things, I go in the restaurant, I have the meal, she says, "What do you want?" Apple pie, ice cream, and so on. Apple pie, ice cream, sherbet, and I say, "For dessert, I'd like strawberry upside down cake." And she says, "We don't have that." And I say, "I'd like strawberry upside down cake." I find myself doing that also, trying to make choices that aren't available, choices that aren't there. And those, I think, throw us into the kinds of problems we get into with choices. Trying to force somebody else to make choices for us, trying to make choices that are not available. Other kinds of problems with choices. I have to face up to it. Sometimes I make wrong choices. Paul Tillich has a very interesting sermon on choices. And he talks about us being stuck with the necessity of making decisions, making choices, but also stuck with the reality that choices are self-limiting. To choose this is to exclude that. Okay, so choices are self-limiting. And choices also have destructive potential. Choices, he says, choices get old. Choices get old. And then I'm faced with trying to renew what was vital in that choice in the first place, or set that choice aside and go somewhere else. Well, we could go on with this for some time, but just talking about what choices are and what the significance of choices are. Summarizing, choices are a fact of life. To go through the day means to make choices. Breakfast at 7 or breakfast at 8. Taking that a little bit further, some choices I would call secondary. They're not too important, breakfast at 7, breakfast at 8. But other choices are primary. Now, later on, while I'm here, I would like to talk some about our facility for running primary and secondary choices together, for focusing on something that's of secondary importance so I don't have to deal with something that's of primary importance. But choice is a fact of life. Some are important, some aren't. How do I sort them out? That other thing I was talking about a bit ago, choices, I think it's out of our choices that we take responsibility for ourselves and we form a selfhood. And to always be escaping from responsibility for choices means to cut out from under, taking shape as a self. So maybe that's kind of the hard side of choice, but on the other side of it, choice is also very freeing. Confronted with alternatives, I have room. It's not necessarily this or necessarily that. And I think this is particularly important as we go into sorting out choices in relation to biblical material. And as we go into taking up this question of choices in the Bible, I would like to work with it out of this kind of structure. I want to talk about the variety of ideas there are within the Bible. The variety of ideas within the Bible. Some of these ideas on one level can seem contradictory. Some of these ideas or facts on one level can seem contradictory. I want to stress from the beginning that I don't like that way of approaching it very well. I don't think it's a matter of seeing materials in the Bible that are contradictory, but rather seeing materials that are different. Okay? I and the lady next to me are not necessarily contradictory. We're different, okay? But a lot of times when people do come to observe differences in the Bible, they assume automatically contradictions. And I want to stress that's not the case. We want to talk about the variety and differences within biblical materials. They do confront us with choices. I think they do confront us with choices. But not contradictions. So as we work this week then, I'd like to have us take a look at the variety within the Bible, on several levels, factual, historical, theological, and then have us play around with the significance of this variety and how we might go about making choices. Then secondly, in relation to the Bible, I'd like to play around some with variety of approaches to the Bible. Variety of approaches. I'm sure many people know the German term Fragestellung, the way I place questions. The way I ask questions has a great deal to do with what kind of answers I'm going to get. And the way I go about asking questions of the Bible will determine a great deal of what I'm going to find there. So So more technically, later on in the week, we'll get into this question of variety of approaches to the Bible, or choices in making approaches. So again, simply this. There's a lot of different material in the biblical text, both on a historical and theological level. This confronts us with choices. Okay? There's a lot of variety within the Bible. This confronts us with choices. Secondly, there are a lot of varied ways we can go about approaching the Bible. There are a lot of different ways we can ask questions of the Bible. This also confronts us with choices. So choices of material within the Bible and choices of approaches to the Bible are what I'd like to work with this week. Over the next couple of days, I'd like to go about it like so. Today I'd like to start out with the stories about Goliath. From those, I'd like to go into material about how Israel came to have a king. Now, I think this is fairly neutral material, and we can look at it carefully and get a hold of some basic tools for going on into looking at material that's more sensitive and more tricky. But today, then, stories about Goliath and the founding of the kingship. And then tomorrow, I'd like to talk about Isaiah 9, verses 1 to 7. Isaiah 9, verses 1 to 7. And there we'll be getting into that second thing, variety and choices in approaches to the Bible. And then on Saturday, I'd like to talk a little bit more technically, not too much, but a little bit more technically about the different kinds of approaches to biblical studies and what might be a valid and less valid choice. Okay, so choices, their importance, choices of materials within the Bible, choices of approaches to the Bible. So much for introduction. Now let's take a look at some stories that probably everybody is familiar with. I have no idea of your background, and if I find out I'm saying things you've already thought through, we'll switch to something else. But let's start out with the Bible quiz. Who killed Goliath? David? Is there any disagreement on that? Obviously, I'm getting into a loaded question here.
Rock.
David, Rock, let me read a passage from 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel chapter 21, verse 19. And listen carefully. I'll read through it a couple of times. First time I'll stumble over the names, and the second time I'll read just the bare outline. In another war with the Philistines in Gob, Elhanan, the son of Jair of Bethlehem, killed Goliath of Gath, whose spear had a shaft like a weaver's beam. So reading just the bare outline of it. 2 Samuel 21, 19. Elhanan killed Goliath. Now, like I say, I have no idea of your background, so for how many is that passage news? Or put it the other way around, how many have run across this reality before? I know that kid in the back there.
Just curious, I think the King James says the brother of Goliath.
Right, right. I think most any contemporary translation, I'm using the New English Bible here, an Oxford Bible, Jerusalem Bible, we'll have it like I've said it. Now that gets us into another issue, a choice of versions, a choice of translations. Maybe we can pause at that just a second. The reason I would use a contemporary translation is this. The King James was translated in 1611. It's based on comparatively few manuscripts. I don't remember the number, something like 20, 30 manuscripts of the Hebrew and Greek of Old Testament and New Testament. None of them are very old. The oldest ones go back to about 900. Okay, so with the King James, few manuscripts, and comparatively recent. And one more point, our understanding of the biblical languages has changed dramatically over the last century. A kid graduating from a good seminary should know more Greek better, I would say, than a lot of those people working on those translations. That's not arrogant, it's just we got more tools. So we've got better tools for translating. A contemporary translation is based on not 20 or 30 manuscripts, but literally hundreds and hundreds. The oldest of those manuscripts for Old Testament goes back probably B.C., and for the New Testament back as far as about 125 A.D. So our manuscripts are 800 to 1,000 years older. We've got a lot more manuscripts. We've got a lot more understanding of the biblical languages. So the King James is in beautiful Elizabethan English, but it's working with tools that are not as good as the ones we have today. So the King James translators oftentimes come out with a different understanding of things. I'll get back to that particular reason for that brother of Goliath in the passage later on. But in a contemporary translation, and typically 2 Samuel 21:19, Elhanan killed Goliath. Okay, the passage most all of us are familiar with is 1 Samuel 17. And I'll read just part of it there. Verses 48 and following. When the Philistines began moving towards him again, David ran quickly to engage him. When the Philistine, singular. And the Philistine is identified previously as Goliath. He, that is David, put his hand into a bag, took out a stone, slung it, struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell flat on his face on the ground. So David proved the victor with his sling and stone. He struck Goliath down and gave him a mortal wound, though he had no sword. Then he ran to the Philistine, stood over him, and grasping his sword, he drew it out of the scabbard, dispatched him, and cut off his head. Okay? So everybody from earliest Sunday school period onwards knows that story. But this is also biblical, 2 Samuel 21:19. Elhanan killed Goliath. And to give us more choices, I'll turn now to 1 Chronicles chapter 20 and verse 5. 1 Chronicles 20 and verse 5. In another war with the Philistines, Elhanan son of Jair killed Lami, brother of Goliath of Gath, whose spear had a shaft like a weaver's beam. Okay? So we've got three stories. One story, 1 Samuel 17, David killed Goliath. The second story, 2 Samuel 21, verse 19, Elhanan killed Goliath. And the third story, in 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5, Elhanan killed the brother of Goliath. Okay, all of us in the room, I imagine, have grown up, really, with biblical studies. Again, the last two versions, Elhanan killed Goliath, Elhanan killed brother of Goliath, we generally don't know about. And I think that's ultimately unfortunate, because what we're missing when we don't get into the complexities of the material, I think, is the richness of the biblical thought. So it's not like the more we know about it, the less it means, but the more we know about it, and the more we look at it, comparing this with that and so on, I think the richer it becomes. The more possibilities, the more choices, the more tools for helping us make sense out of ordinary everyday living we find there. So I'm very uncomfortable sitting down and talking. So let's go back over this material now. 1 Samuel 17, 2 Samuel 21, 19, and 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5. We've got choices there. Let's talk about some of the issues or questions that are raised, first of all. So we see those three different stories. What are some of the problems, issues, questions raised by that reality? What are the implications of this? What do you see as significance of it?
What about just the accuracy of the reporting?
Okay, the accuracy of the reporting. And when we're dealing not just with any old book, but with our sacred books, or the source and norm of Christian teaching, that raises a bunch of problems. This is, again, a thing I'll work with throughout the time here. Since 200 A.D., there hasn't been a great deal of disagreement within Christianity as to the source and norm of Christian teaching. Left and right, conservatives and liberals, Catholics, Presbyterians, Lutherans, and so on and so on. Everybody has pretty well agreed for 1,700 years. These are the basic books. This is where you get the basic picture. But the reality is we take those same basic books and go a lot of different directions. And we want to deal with that as we talk about choices of approach to the Bible. But here we have our sacred books in, source and norm for our teachings, and we find there different stories. So one way of responding would be to say, what are the facts? If we find materials here that are different, we can move another step and say they're contradictory, and we can say then, what do we know? What else? What other kinds of questions are raised? I suppose mechanical questions like, who killed Goliath? So questions like, what of the accuracy of the reporting? And a step away from what Dean is saying there then is, what about the accuracy of the Bible? Which becomes then for us in our society, I think, generally and rightfully so, a very scary kind of question. What about the accuracy of the reporting? And a step further, what about the accuracy of our sacred books? So we're getting into some things that are very sensitive and very important. And I want to stress then again from the beginning, One way of looking at this is to say, look, there are contradictions. Another way of looking at it, that I think is quite a different way, is to say, look, there are differences. There are differences. So the differences raise this kind of question. One, what's the accuracy of the reporting? What's the accuracy of our sacred books? But another direction that these differences take us is into questions like this. Why are there differences? Why are there differences? The biblical people, the people who did the editing on this material, the Deuteronomists, somewhere down around 600 AD, as he did the final compiling of this material, I'm sure knew there were those different stories in those first two accounts, 1 Samuel 17, 2 Samuel 21. So it wouldn't be news for him. It's not something somebody who didn't like the Bible found out about in the 20th century, but rather way back in 600 BC, as these materials were being compiled, the editor knew this. He knew there's one story here, another story here. So it's news for us rather than for them. And the question it leads into is, why the differences? Why the differences? So what's the accuracy of the material? What's the accuracy of our sacred books? But a more important question, why the differences? Okay, let's let that rest for a little bit and let's take up another question. So there are different accounts there, three different stories. How could you resolve those differences? What are some ways of resolving the differences in the accounts? Just let your imagination roll. How much you work out the differences we see there?
Well, it would be like any accident today. Two people look at the same accident and say somebody was injured and the other one say he was killed, and you probably saw the wrong person did it or something like that. This is possible.
Right, however many there are in the room, say there are 40 of us, if we said right now everybody take out paper and pencil and describe the room and the people in it, we'd get, you know. Okay, so people see things differently. That's one way of dealing with the differences. What else?
There may be more than one person named Goliath.
Okay, you could have a whole bunch of Goliaths. You could say Goliath is like Smith, or Smith's on the boat coming around. Yeah, boat, bus coming up the other day. So, lots of Goliaths. What else? What other kinds of possibilities?
The story may have been told with a different purpose in mind. You know, the person who was telling that David killed him might want to wonder if you, you know, impress on people how wonderful David was or how much God he could put whatever in treason.
How comfortable are you with finding that in our sacred scriptures?
But I just think that it seems to me that a lot of the Old Testament history is told with a bias.
How about New Testament history?
Well, I suppose that is true.
I'd like to, yeah, go ahead.
Well, if you consider that these stories were told, and then you tell them to your children tell them to their children before they maybe ever got put down, I'm sure there are inaccuracies. And it really didn't seem to make a lot of difference to me if David or Alhambra or whatever his name was killed Goliath, but the fact that God's providence was there and he was protecting them and so forth is an important thing, isn't it?
Okay, that could be a possibility. It's a story told to talk about God's protection of us. I think a big choice comes down like this, is the material there, are the differences there by accident or on purpose? Okay? And if they're there on purpose, then I think there might be something important on the other side of simply a story to tell us about God's protection. Yeah?
Well, I was just thinking, are there two different stories? Two different killings with two different Goliaths?
Okay, entirely different people. That's what I think this guy was getting at. Maybe lots of Goliaths. But I think you know, one way of looking at the choices in relation to this passage would be like so. Is it an accident or on purpose? What kind of purpose? Let's proceed with this. Now, again, you got lots of choices. You can leave saying there were probably a lot of Goliaths, or saying there were lots of people saw the event. People see things differently. There are different stories there. But I think it comes down to a choice like this. Is it an accident? Is it on purpose? And what I would argue, or what I would think, is this, that it's not an accident, that it's on purpose. And picking up with what the lady over here was saying, I think that it's possible to put the material into its historical setting and see some very important purposes behind the differences in the accounts here.
Can I ask a question?
Sure, yeah.
If you look in 1 Samuel 17th chapter, and it says that Goliath of Gath, says that, and then in the 2 Samuel account, it says Goliath the Gittite.
Yeah.
Are those different areas? I'm sorry, I don't really know.
That's how you'd say somebody's from Gath. Like you say, you could say John of Holden or John the Holdenite.
Okay,
Gath,
I didn't know if they were the same or not.
Yeah.
That's why I was asking.
Sure, you know, make your comments and give your questions whenever you want. Okay, accident or purpose. And I'm going to proceed and talk about it out of the possibility that there are some important purposes going on here. And as we talk about those purposes, that'll take us down into these stories also. 1 Samuel chapters 8 to 10, which gives us one story as to how Israel came to have a king. And 1 Samuel 11, which gives us a different story as to how Saul became king in Israel. Okay, 1 Samuel 17. Who's the hero in the story in 1 Samuel 17? Okay, David. I suppose you could say God, but David is the agent there. In the second story, 2 Samuel 21, 19, Elhanan. And what's going on down in 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5, very much like what the King James did with this passage. Okay, the King James has this passage say, Elhanan killed the brother of Goliath. There's not textual evidence for that. That means somebody changed the text in order to have it read, Elhanan killed the brother of Goliath, which seems to me to probably not be fair. But down here in 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5, we do have a biblical passage that says, Elhanan killed the brother of Goliath. So 1 Samuel 17, David, 2 Samuel, Elhanan, and 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5 is saying, no problem, okay? It all works out okay. It's smoothing over the differences. If I tell a story about George Washington, and I say George Washington threw a silver dollar across the Rappahannock, it's a glorification of George Washington. Some revisionist comes along a few years later, and he says, it wasn't really the Rappahannock River, it was Railroad Creek. It's not as big of a deal. If someone says David kills Goliath the Gittite, it's a glorification then, or it's a support for David. And if someone says Elhanan killed Goliath, that's sort of saying, well, you know, maybe David wasn't so much. But there are historical reasons for this kind of thing going on in the biblical materials. In order to see those reasons, I think we have to trace a little bit of the history. In order to see those reasons, we have to trace a little of the history. Israel emerged into Palestine down around 1200 BC. Okay, they began as a nation. We usually talk about a nation when a people has its own history, culture, written remains. Israel began as a nation around 1200 BC. Their form of government from roughly 1200 BC down to about 1050 BC. Their form of government is very loose. Their form of government is a tribal confederacy. Israel has a loose tribal setup, 1200 to 1050. It's a difficult period. It's a period that's talked about in the Book of the Judges. And the Book of the Judges says things are really chaotic. The archaeologist verifies this. We find a line that's repeated biblically there. It's every tribe for themselves, every man for themselves. And so Israel's having a hard time holding together with this tribal confederacy. They're not the only people trying to control this landmass of Israel or Palestine. There are also the Canaanites, the Edomites, the Moabites, the Philistines are moving in and so on. There are all sorts of people contesting for control of that little bitty country. And as we move down towards 1050, it seems like the Philistines are going to win out. A betting man would probably bet on the Philistines. They've gotten control of the iron industry. So if you want your spears in Israel, you have to go buy iron spears from the Philistines, okay? Not a good situation if you have to buy your weapons from the enemy. And repeatedly, the Philistines are winning one victory after another. And many people in Israel say the problem is we need a more stable form of government. We need a more stable form of government. And it's at this time that there emerges a flesh and blood king in Israel. The time in which Israel forms the monarchy is between 1050 and 1000 BC. And key figures there are the figures Samuel, who is one of the judges, and Saul, who is the first of the kings. Okay, Samuel, one of the judges, Saul, first of the kings. The people come to Samuel in 1 Samuel chapter 8. They come to Samuel. I won't read the whole passage to save some time here, but skip over it, and you can read it in greater detail more carefully later. Samuel grew old. He appointed his sons judges in Israel. The people don't think his sons are working out. And so they come to Samuel, and they say to him, "You're old now, and your sons do not follow in your footsteps. Appoint us a king to govern us like other nations." But the request for a king to govern them displeased Samuel, and he prayed the Lord. Now, does anybody have some background here where they know why Samuel got ticked off at the Israelites because they wanted a king? See, things are falling apart. The Philistines are taking over. Some people say the problem is we don't have any stable government. It's every tribe to themselves. The threat comes along, we go 12 directions. We need something to hold us together. How about a king?
Wasn't there something about God being their king in their religious ceremonies or something like that?
So yeah.
He was supposed to be their king.
Yeah, very good. Samuel is displeased because he says, "We have a king." What do you mean, have a king? We have a king. Yahweh, one of the key Old Testament words for God, Yahweh is king in Israel. And here we have to put ourselves back into their kind of thought world. For us, politics and government is over here, economics over here, social life over here, family life here, education, worship, and so on. In our society, things are really, alas, quite fragmented. In their society, typically in the ancient world, everything focused in religion. The temple was the center not only of worship, but of entertainment and education and politics and everything else. And so life was more of a whole for them than it was for us. This has happened many times in history. For them, things weren't so fragmented. Things held together. They had a focus. And that focus was their religion. And in their religion, in the Old Testament period then, one of their key names for God is Yahweh. And Yahweh is understood as king in Israel. So people come and say, "Let's have a king." Samuel becomes very upset. He says, "We have a king. Yahweh is king." So then I'd like to read quite a bit of the passage that follows. Their request for a king to govern them displeased Samuel. He prayed to the Lord. The Lord answered Samuel, "Listen to the people and all that they are saying. They have not rejected you. It is I whom they have rejected, I whom they will not have to be their king. They are now doing to you just what they have done to me since I brought them up out of Egypt. They have forsaken me and worshipped other gods. Hear what they have to say now, but give them a solemn warning and tell them what sort of king will govern them." Samuel told the people who were asking for a king all that the Lord had said to him. And then I think a really fascinating passage. It seems to me like it'd really be good to pick out texts pertinent directly to political science in the Bible and take a look at them carefully. But Samuel goes back to the people and he says, "Look, dummies, so you can have a king. You have to learn for yourself. Here's what a king will be like." Samuel told the people, "This will be the sort of king who will govern you. He will take your sons and make them serve in his chariots and with his cavalry, and will make them run before his chariots. Some he will appoint officers over units of 1,000 and units of 50. Others will plow his fields and reap his harvest. Others again will make weapons of war and equipment for mounted troops. He will take your daughters for perfumers, cooks, and confectioners. He will seize the best of your cornfields, vineyards, olive yards, and give them to his lackeys. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage to give to his eunuchs and lackeys. Your slaves, both men and women, and the best of your cattle and your asses he will seize and put to his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks," and so on. For comfort, on April 15th, I read that. Okay, in ancient Israel, there are lots of different streams of thought, but what we see here in the Samuel passage is the idea that man is directly responsible before God, and nobody and nothing else can get in the road. And he's saying what government will do. If you have a flesh and blood king, there are things get in between you and Yahweh that will make the whole question of responsibility much more difficult to deal with. Okay? So in 1 Samuel 8, 9, 10, Samuel is opposed to monarchy. He says having a king is a bad idea. We shouldn't do it. Yahweh is king. That's more than sufficient. So finally the people, he says to people, okay, so have a king. The people of Israel draw lots, kind of like whoever gets the shortest straw through all Israel. And the lots fall on Saul. And Saul then with Samuel's disagreement. Read through the passage later on today when you have time. Up in 1 Samuel 10, Samuel summons the Israelites, 1 Samuel 10, 17. This is the word of the Lord, the God of Israel. I brought you up, I delivered you, and so on. Now you've turned away from me. You say, set a king over us. With Samuel's displeasure at a place called Mizpah, after Saul has been chosen by lots, Saul is crowned king in Israel. So they have a monarch, a flesh and blood king. So 1 Samuel 8, 9, 10 is opposed to the monarchy. It's an anti-monarchy story. Because it's saying that's going to foul up your relationship and responsibility before God. Now I'd like to read another passage that's in favor of the monarchy. 1 Samuel chapter 11. It's a magnificent passage. I've always thought it would make a grand epic movie. About a month later, Nahash the Ammonite attacked and besieged Jabesh-Gilead. So Gilead is a territory in what is today Jordan, and Jabesh is a city in Gilead. And the Ammonites, another one of those people contesting for control, and Jabesh, king of the Ammonites, or Nahash, king of the Ammonites. So Nahash the Ammonite comes up to Jabesh-Gilead. He lays siege to the city. The men of Jabesh said to Nahash, come to terms with us, and we'll be your subject. So they say, you know, why fight? We can work out something, this Hebrew city. And Nahash says, okay, we can work out a contract. Nahash answered them, on one condition only will I come to terms with you, that I gouge out your right eyes and bring disgrace on Israel. So he says, sure, we can work out terms, but such terms. The elders of Jabesh-Gilead then said, what seems to me to really be a very strange thing. Give us 7 days respite to send messengers throughout Israel, and then if no one relieves us, we will surrender to you. So what they say in essence is this, give us a week to find some troops. If we don't find any, okay. When the messengers came, so the messengers go through all Israel, and when they came to Gibeah, which is a little village just to the north of Jerusalem, when they came to Gibeah where Saul lived and delivered their message, all the people broke into lamentation. Saul was just coming from the field, driving in oxen and asking why the people were lamenting, and they repeated what the men of Jabesh had said. When Saul heard this, the Spirit of God suddenly seized him. In his anger, he took a pair of oxen and cut them in pieces and sent messengers with the pieces all through Israel to proclaim that the same would be done to the oxen of any man who did not follow Saul and Samuel into battle.
Yay.
So it's a draft notice. He's saying, okay. Uncle Saul wants you or else. The fear of the Lord fell upon the people, and
was Saul king yet? He wasn't.
No, he's not king.
Yeah.
He's not king.
Yeah, he's already taken over.
He's crowned king back in 1 Samuel 10, but a thing we can talk about more, we're working with different sources compiled for very specific theological reasons down later on. So again, I'd like to stress this throughout. I don't think contradictions. I don't think that gets at the purposes at all, but rather differences, very important in their own historical setting, and I think very worthwhile for us to look at very carefully. The fear of the Lord fell upon the people, and they came out to a man. Saul mustered them in Bezek, and there were 300,000 men from Israel and 30,000 from Judah. He said to the men who brought the message, tell the men of Jabesh-Gilead. So I'll skip over it. Saul leads the troops into battle up in Jabesh. They wipe out the Ammonites. Nahash is killed. And then the tail end of the passage. Then the people said to Samuel, who said that Saul should not reign over us? So they're saying, what do you mean we can't have a king? Hand the men over to us to be put to death. So a very different version of things, you know, from what we saw in that earlier passage. But Saul said, no man shall be put to death on a day when the Lord has won such a victory in Israel. Samuel said to the people, let us now go to Gilgal, and there renew our allegiance to the kingdom. So they all went to Gilgal, and invested Saul there as king in the presence of the Lord, sacrificing shared offerings and so on. So in this story, 1 Samuel 11, it would seem like this. Saul is crowned king with the acclaim of the people and without Samuel's objection, after winning a great victory at Jabesh and Gilead. Okay, so again, the two stories. 1 Samuel 8, 9, 10, things are falling apart. The people come. They say, give us a king. Samuel says, no, this is what a king will do. Okay, dummies, have a king. They draw lots, and the lot falls on Saul. With Samuel's objection, Saul is crowned king at Mizpah. 1 Samuel 11, trouble in Jabesh-Gilead. Samuel, or rather Saul, musters troops by threat. They go to Jabesh. They win a victory. The people are much impressed with Saul. They choose him, claim him as king. He is crowned king without Samuel's objection at a different place, a place called Gilgal. So two different stories. And again, like we were talking about before, you can resolve them. You can say he was crowned king twice or whatever. Different people see things differently, or there's one moral lesson in the two stories or whatever. So there are, again, so many ways you can go about dealing with them. You can deal with it and say it's contradictions. It's like I thought. It's a bunch of nonsense. Throw it out. Okay? So many choices. Choices to bring the two stories together. Say they're simply two accounts of his crowning of king. There are two contradictions thrown out. They're both teaching the same lesson. They're very distinct stories, each with its own theological purpose. Okay? Really a lot of choices to make in looking at the text. I would suggest, or the understanding, the choice that I myself would favor, then simply this. We have different theologies in ancient Israel. Our religion is the way we go about dealing with the question of who we are. We can put it more formally. Religion, not simply a system of worship and belief, but religion, the way I go about dealing with the question of my identity and direction. The way I answer the question, who are you? What's worthwhile? Okay? And what we have behind these two passages in ancient Israel, I think, are two different understandings of how one can go about dealing with the questions of identity and direction. The first passage is saying you can't deal meaningfully with the question of who you are in and through a formal government, a monarchy. And the second passage is saying, yes, you can. A government can help give structure. It can help give balance and direction in dealing with the questions of identity and direction. And see, they aren't questions we've gotten away from. We struggle with those ourselves in all the time. And two different understandings, two different theologies, two different ways of dealing way back there in ancient Israel. So, continuing then, an anti-monarchy story for those kinds of reasons, a pro-monarchy story. This business of the kingship was a problem throughout the history of ancient Israel. It wasn't only here back around 1051,000, but it remained a problem. Saul is king in Israel from roughly 1050 to 1000. And you remember, many of you, Saul is succeeded by, not by his eldest son, who normally would have been king. Rather, his son is given different names in the Old Testament. One of them is a very nasty name. I can't imagine anyone giving it to their kid. One of the names for Saul's son who loses the throne is Ishbosheth, which means man of shame. Man of shame because he wasn't able to hold on to what Saul had established. Rather, the monarchy is taken over by David. And we have different histories in the Old Testament. In the Deuteronomic history, David comes through the Deuteronomic history, Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. David comes through as a fairly bloodthirsty military political figure. He's not glossed over. His problems with his son, who revolts against him, his affair with Bathsheba, all sorts of things. The skullduggery by way of which he became king. All of that's laid out in great detail in the Deuteronomic history. And the Deuteronomic history goes into spelling out how David dealt with the objections to the monarchy. David, it seems, fairly early in his life had set for himself the goal of bringing all Israel together under his kingship. The goal is of bringing together all Israel under his kingship. And he really does what is necessary in order to do that. You remember the stories. He breaks off from Saul, or they break off from each other. Saul sees David as a political threat, which certainly was accurate. And there's a clash between David and Saul. David goes back to his home territory. He holds up in the hills down along the Dead Sea at Ein Gedi. He puts together his own private army. He makes a treaty with guess who? Not with Saul, but with the Philistines, saying, you don't bother me, I won't bother you. And plays a sort of Robin Hood role, robbing from the bad guys according to his lights and giving to the good. What David is doing is he's building up a base of support, his own private army, his own loyal, faithful followers who are dependent on him and go along with his ideas, all this sort of thing, until finally when Saul is killed in battle, or is taken and put to death in battle, he's ready to move. And then David makes an agreement with Saul's leading general. He pulls the monarchy out from under Ishbosheth and establishes himself as king over all Israel. And he does a number of things to consolidate the kingdom. He apparently was a brilliant military leader. He wins a number of victories. He gives them some safe borders. He establishes a neutral capital. Like, we don't have our capital in Boston or Richmond or whatever, but rather in federal territory, Washington. David also establishes Jerusalem, which is, in essence, federal territory for the capital. So he tries to meet all the objections to the monarchy, and he tries to bring the country together under his stable rule. But what's the biggest objection he's going to have to deal with? All down through the history, some people say, we have a king, Yahweh is king. Okay? So the biggest objection to the monarchy, to his monarchy, that David is going to have to deal with, is this idea that God is king in Israel and David is the usurper. Okay? And we have a passage out of the Deuteronomic history, 2 Samuel 7, a very important Old Testament passage, that gives the theological rationale for a Davidic monarchy. It gives the theological reasons why there should be David and his descendants ruling over Israel. The story is told like this. David is old. He's in his declining years. He says, I want to build a house. We really have to cut 9:15.
Okay,
supposed to start
9:15.
Okay, so
can you wind it up?
I didn't know it was at 10. Yeah. All right. Sorry. Yeah, okay, so the kingship then established by David, and take a look at 2 Samuel 7, we'll pick up with that tomorrow, theological reasons for it.
Oh, good.
As we finished yesterday, I suggested that we take a look at 2 Samuel 7, and I hope you've had time to do that before class today, but basically what 2 Samuel 7 does is this, it gives a theological rationale for having a Davidic king. It gives what for some people were sound theological reasons for having a Davidic king. The story is roughly like this. David is old. He says, I'd like to do something for Yahweh. I'd like to build him a house. And there's a play on words there. Nathan the prophet goes away and he comes back and says, you don't have to build a house for Yahweh. Yahweh will build a house for you. Okay? So instead of David building a temple, Yahweh will build a dynasty for David. And what the passage does then is to spell out a theological rationale. And I'll read just a couple of verses. It is he, that is David and his household, it is he who shall build a house in honor of my name, and I will establish his royal throne forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. So the Davidic king in Israel was really understood in kind of the role of adopted son. In his coming into the kingship, he's taken into the role of son of Yahweh. Not in sort of biological sense, but in an adopted and qualitative sense. I will be his father, he shall be my son. When he does wrong, I will punish him as any father might, and not spare the rod. My love will never be withdrawn from him, as I withdrew it from Saul, whom I removed from your path. Your family shall be established, your kingdom shall stand for all time, and so on. So if you're of the house of David, or of that school of thought, it's a neat passage. It gives a rationale why Yahweh is on your side and will take care of things in your favor. When you do wrong, he'll correct you. Through the house of David, he'll work out his intentions with all Israel. Okay? But the reality is that not all of Israel bought in on that passage. Okay? See, 2 Samuel 7 gives theological reasons why they can have a king and why the king should be of the house of David. But not everybody in Israel agreed. We can see that very clearly because in 920, David's dates again, roughly 1000 to 960. He's succeeded by Solomon, 960 to 920. But then in 920, the united Davidic kingdom falls apart. It falls apart for these kinds of reasons. Someone has said Solomon died in just the nick of time. He had fostered enough problems that were coming to a head that things had to change. But he had fostered or developed problems like this. He had made inroads for foreign religions. Remember his many wives and concubines, those are political. And when these wives and concubines come into Israel, they're allowed to bring with them their own religion. So it's not an objection to his sexual activity, but rather an objection to bringing in foreign religions. And this is coming to a head then at the time of Solomon's death. Another line we find in a number of passages in the Deuteronomic history that I talked about yesterday. The other people who are not of the tribes related to David, closely related to David, say simply, "We have no place in Israel." David and Solomon favor their own people and their own territory. And if you're not of their tribe and territory, you're in trouble. We have no place in Israel. A number of other objections, but these objections come to a head at the time of the crowning of Rehoboam, Solomon's son, and the kingdom splits into two parts. 5/6 of the country, in essence, reject 2 Samuel 7 and splits off and forms the northern kingdom. 1/6 of the country sticks with the Davidic ideas like we see in 2 Samuel 7. So ancient Israel had really problems like us, differences in theology, different understandings of how to approach living. How to answer the question, who am I? What makes for sense? So 2 Samuel 7 gives reasons for a Davidic monarchy. Not everybody bought in on them, so the country splits into two parts in 920. Some sticking with those ideas, some rejecting it. So in line with that, we can go back now just briefly to the stories of David and Goliath. If you're in favor of the monarchy, you're in favor of the Davidic monarchy, a story like David killed Goliath in 1 Samuel 17. And if you're opposed to the Davidic monarchy, then a little line like 2 Samuel 21:19, Elhanan killed Goliath. Okay? And we find this sort of thing and running throughout the biblical materials. What I'm saying is I don't think the differences are accidental. I don't think it's an error in translation or whatever, but it's on purpose. And it's just like everybody in the room knows, within our country, there are all different kinds of schools of theology. Some points of contact, some really wild points of difference. If we were to take simply us 400 or so people here at Holden, we have a lot of different theologies going on, a lot of different ideas about how to deal with the questions of identity and direction. And it might be nice if this were not so in ancient Israel or in the biblical materials, but I think it is. They also have their theological differences, and I think it's theological differences then that stand behind the different stories about David, Goliath, Elhanan. There are two basic histories in the Old Testament. The first, the Deuteronomic history, runs from Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. And those two passages then, 1 Samuel 17, 2 Samuel 21, David, Elhanan, the two different stories there, come out of the Deuteronomic history. Now we don't have time to go into his setting and his purposes, the Deuteronomist, but I want to mention then the third passage just briefly here. The third passage, 1 Chronicles chapter 20, verse 5, comes out of the second major history in the Old Testament. It comes out of the chronicler's history. This consists of 1 and 2 Chronicles, Ezra and Nehemiah. Now, the Deuteronomist history has a long, complex background, but it's put together down around 600, at the time, roughly the time of the fall of the southern kingdom, the collapse of the nation. The chronicler's history, again, a long, complex background, but it's put together down around 400. Around 400, another theological development in Israel. There emerges the priestly theology with the idea that Israel doesn't need to be a nation, that they were mistaken in trying to be a nation in the first place. What they need to be is simply a religious community focused in temple and covenant, the covenant as understood in the book of Leviticus. And what they say then, what some people are saying down around 400, If we are a religious community focused in temple and covenant, then we can make sense out of life, a whole theology going along with this. And with that theology, a rewriting of history to back up that particular point, the chronicler's history. What the chronicler does with David is very interesting. He glosses over David's problems. David's son who revolted against him, this story is left out of the chronicler's history. The story of David and Bathsheba, the chronicler leaves this out. He doesn't say it's false, he just doesn't refer to these things. He's painting a different picture of David. Instead of David, the warrior politician like we see in the Deuteronomic history, we see David, fairly pious sort of fellow. In the Deuteronomic history, one of the last things David does on his deathbed is to give orders for killing off some of his former friends he's decided are really his enemies. In the chronicler's history, the last thing David does on his deathbed is give the plans for the building of the temple. Okay? So the history again, nobody writes history, I would say, exactly as it really happened. We pick, select, choose, arrange. in order to get across a particular viewpoint. So I think not so much a matter of contradictions, but a matter of differences. Differences that are intentional on purpose in order to support and illustrate and explain a particular kind of theology. Okay? And I think then that's about all the time that I'll take in talking about the David and Goliath stories and the establishment of the monarchy. 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5, then, is like the other chronicle material on David. It's glossing over the problems. So instead of... See, they also knew. There was a story, 1 Samuel 17 says David killed Goliath. 2 Samuel 21 says Elhanan did. And he resolves it, the chronicler, much like the King James Bible. Elhanan killed the brother of Goliath. Like the King James does with 2 Samuel 21. Okay, I'd like to take just a few minutes here for seeing what kinds of questions or comments or ideas or whatever. What needs further explaining, and what are you people thinking about? Are we ready to go on?
Differences of theology, then you wouldn't hold to a uniform verbal inspiration.
No.
Because a lot of Christians do.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is one of the things I'm working towards with this material. I'm saying two things. You know, one thing, there are differences within the material. Like, you know, we didn't create the two passages in about David and Goliath and Elhanan. They're there. Our reality is we gloss them over. You know, we tend not to deal with them. So I'm saying one thing, there are differences there. And then a second thing I'm working towards talking about more directly is differences in approaches. So one approach is it's inerrant, infallible, and so on.
Right.
And if I take that position, which is, I think, a legitimate choice, I would like to emphasize that also. It's not for me to say, you know, don't do this, do it my way, or whatever. I think it's very important that we respect each other's choices. But I think the problems come when I or someone else says, shut up and do it this way. Okay? Whether it's inerrant and infallible, or it's what I'll call the historical critical methodology, or whatever. It seems to me very important we see, instead of all good guys do it this way, these are choices. Choices in approach. And to really, you know, try to respect each other's choices. This is the way I see it, because. And talk about supports and implications for our choices. I'd like to work at it this way. I'd like to, we've taken an account there, David and Goliath, where there are differences in the telling of the story. And you can resolve those differences a lot of different ways. We'll talk about that again when we get into speaking directly about different approaches. Now I'd like to take Isaiah 9 when we're ready here. And with that, I'm going to simply talk about how do we usually understand this passage, how is it, I think, most often treated, and then talk about it out of a historical critical approach. Okay, so we'll be doing what you're saying there. We'll be taking a look at a couple of different approaches to it. And then I want to add three, four more on the other side of that. So I'm saying, the way we go about studying the Bible, there's not simply one right way. There are a lot of different ways, and the choice of approach we take is going to make a lot of difference in what we're going to come up with.
I have a question.
Yeah.
The inerrant, infallible approach is kind of popular today, or it seems that people a lot of people are working towards that. How do they handle this? How would you handle this? You say you can take a lot of approaches. You can take the historical critical approach. You can take the inerrant and infallible approach. How would the inerrant and infallible approach handle the differences of the David Goliath thing?
Well, I've heard all sorts of different answers. You could start out, I suppose, on one extreme. You could say God put different stories there to test our faith. Okay, some people, it seems to me that's way over on one end. Another common way of dealing with it is to say, if we had the originals, we'd know. You know, if we had the original text. Another common way of dealing with it is like we see in the King James Version. The textual evidence is against saying in 2 Samuel 21:19, Elhanan killed the brother of Goliath. It simply says in the manuscripts, Elhanan killed Goliath. But you can amend the text. You can say, I think they made a mistake, I think it should read.
That's not inerrant anymore.
Well, the way it's said usually is if we have the original manuscripts, they are in there. All we have is copies.
Okay.
But, you know, by my way of thinking, it's difficult to maintain. But for some people, it's not difficult, and it's important. And it's their way of seeing it.
Hard to imagine how they do rationalize it.
I think one of the most helpful things in looking at the different approaches is to see how they develop historically. And I'd like to, as time permits next week, develop that a little bit. And I think every approach has some very good things about it. Those people who take the idea of inerrancy, infallibility as their choice, I think are emphasizing something that's very important, and that is that the Bible is source and norm of Christian teaching. They're underlining that. I'm not able to follow along with where they go from that, but I think it's important to emphasize that particular idea. I'm sure there must be people in here who would favor that approach of inerrant and infallible, or what I would label a literalistic approach. And I like to emphasize that I think it's important to respect that as a choice, not to assume it as a necessity, but to respect it as a choice.
It's curious when I think one of the questions comes up where somebody says, well, what is the Word of God from that to me for my faith? When you delve into the history, the average person may not get into that many implications of the story just because they feel that they're not going to discover a Word of God for them by all that work, so they're not going to go a lot of trouble. But let's say a story like David and Goliath, what does that have to say? You can pull something out for Sunday school kids and say, you know, David had a lot of faith in God. He trusted, you know, and that's the thing, we should trust like David trusted. And, you know, if they don't have to go any further than that for an inspiring word for themselves, then they're not going to delve into all those questions, and it's just a lot easier to go the other route.
I think there's a bunch of I really feel under pressure of time to take up a lot of the things that would be interesting. But if we would take the question, what's the relevance of the David Goliath material for us? I think there's really a whole bunch to talk about. It seems to me if you take that passage that I read there a bit ago out of 2 Samuel 7 about, you know, God chose me and through me he'll do what he wants, it seems to me that's an old story. We hear it a lot of, you know, different times in different ways today. And it's fine if you are in the house of David. It gives you an ultimate justification. It's a beautiful, interesting passage, 2 Samuel 7, but as far as its implications, it seems to me to be not so good, you know. The idea that God would choose one particular house through them, we see what happened historically. What the rest of Israel says is, where's our part in the whole business? The house of David favors the house of David.